Hello, everyone. We're glad you found us, and welcome to our podcast at antiqueauctionforum.com. We hope you find this show entertaining and informative.
This is Martin Willis
and Phyllis Gao,
and on the line with us is who I consider one of the best door knockers pickers in the country, Greg Willett. How you doing, Greg?
I'm doing just great. Hi, except Greg. For the small flush that I'm feeling right now from your praise.
Now you're in Wisconsin,
30 miles south of Lambeau Field. Go Pack, go!
Years ago, I
fell in love with a cheesehead and sold my business in Kennebunkport, Maine, and moved here.
Really? Yes. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we knew each other in Kennebunk. And we met, I'm not going to go into this long story, but you and I met back in 1977 on the road.
In a rest stop, Marty, but we don't like to tell people about that.
Oh, yes.
So did you fell in love with Marty? Is that what you're saying?
No. Hey, this is starting out wrong. So anyway, we met at a rest area. You had all kinds of antiques on your van, and that's how I knew you were someone on the road in the business I was in. And so we've known each other all the way back since then.
Yeah, it's been a long time. Seems like just yesterday.
Oh, in some ways, yes. So let's talk about pickers, and let's talk about what is the difference between a door knocker and a picker.
Well, all door knockers are pickers, but not all pickers are door knockers. Door knockers go out and they make their living by going door to door and buying antiques in situ, we call it in Latin, in sight.
Yes.
And it's not for everybody. It's hard, but it's profitable. It's fun. It's exciting. It's dangerous. Pickers go and they knock some doors. Some pickers knock doors. But most pickers pick other sources of antiques, including door knockers, shops,
yes,
auctions, and shows. So, and another major difference between the two, door knockers in general are willing to buy anything of value in a home. And used to be anything antique of value in a home. And now a lot of the door knockers are buying anything of value, period.
Hmm.
Even a riding lawnmower or a snowblower or whatever, anything they put in the truck and that they could sell usually at the end of the day or at the end of the week. Most pickers are known to have ants in their pants when it comes to owning merchandise. Most pickers like to sell before the sun goes down, before the week is out. The pickers are usually specified. They're looking for certain things. One picker might be looking for jewelry. Another picker might be looking for fine art or pottery. Mm-hmm. Another picker might be looking for furniture. They tend to be more specialized. And if you're specialized, it's very hard to knock a door because you'll go many, 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 many doors before you're finding the one category of item that you're looking for.
Uh-huh.
So that's a major difference.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were both, right?
Yes.
I mean, I should say you are both. Yes.
But it depends on the venue. I primarily am a door knocker. I knocked my first door when I was 8 years old, but that was to sell light bulbs for the Boy Scouts. One thing I learned was that if I knocked the doors in the wealthy neighborhoods, they bought more light bulbs. And my first year, I sold more light bulbs than anybody in the troop, and I was awarded a Bowie knife, a hunting knife, as a first prize, which I immediately decided to show to my sisters. And I terrorized them, and my father took the knife away from me, and I never saw it again.
So,
the next time I knocked doors was when I was 10 years old. I had an uncle in the business, and in order to get away from my three mean and evil sisters, I would go out on weekends with him.
Oh, and so you had an uncle in the business?
Yes, and he wasn't the best. Let's put it this way: he was never invited back to a house.
Oh,
he was known for buying as much or as little as possible. As a matter of fact, my job in his operation was, if he was standing at the door of the house and couldn't get in within the first 2 minutes, I was supposed to hop out of the truck and drag my leg behind me and say, Dad, we bought enough today for my operation.
Oh my gosh.
Now, this is a joke, right?
That part is a joke.
Yes. You have me going there. Yes,
but if we have time later when we talk about dirty door knocker tricks, remind me to tell you about Jacques Chaubert, and we'll come back to something along those lines.
Okay, sure.
So, yeah. But then, I started picking when I became a full-time dealer in 73 or 4, and then I realized very, very quickly that it's more fun and more interesting and sometimes cheaper buying if you're buying directly out of a house instead of through intermediaries.
Now, I do remember a conversation we had before. You used to pick and door knock in one area and then sell in another area, and you unloaded your things fairly quickly as well, didn't you?
Yes, and that was in the old days. It was because of financial stress. You only had so much money to work with. When I started knocking doors in Maryland in the 70s, I had an El Camino and $200, and I would always come home with money in my pocket and no space in the back of the truck. Well, that doesn't happen today. You don't even leave. If you're picking for a day, if you're knocking doors for a day or picking whatever, you don't leave with less than a couple of grand in your pocket. And if you go out for a week, then it's a whole different story. When I was in Maine, I picked many, many places in the United States. But the most fun I had in the United States was when I picked in Maine, and I would go to Nova Scotia. And we would leave on a Monday. And you didn't come home until your truck was full or your wallet was empty. Mm-hmm. And it took a little more than $2,000 to do that, to fill out the truck and the trailer. So. Mm-hmm.
In the title, I called you the global picker instead of the American picker.
Yes, I've heard tales of your many travels abroad. Are they true?
Yeah. let's see. The first place that I picked internationally was I picked the border towns in Mexico for Wurlitzer jukeboxes, and that was in the 70s, and then when we moved to Maine, I picked very heavily in the Maritimes, as I just told you, practically every other week. There's no city or village in the province of Nova Scotia that I have not knocked doors in.
Wow.
Not to say that I've been to every house, but I have literally geographically covered every area and every municipality and village in that province, many in New Brunswick, a few in Canada, a few in Quebec.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's a language barrier in Quebec, so the French is mandatory to do any good. And then we went to Spain, and I actually knocked doors in Spain.
Mm.
I tried knocking doors in France, but the French are difficult.
Mm.
And it wasn't my language. It was just the fact that I was not French.
Mm-hmm.
I see.
And then most recently, I've knocked doors in China, and that was very, very interesting.
Yeah.
It wasn't easy to accomplish that as well. It took a lot of preparation work to get the permission to work in the villages.
Oh, I see. Who did you go for permission?
Well, it's all government controlled.
Mm-hmm.
And first of all, we have the language barrier, so you have to have a really good translator.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have a network, because what do you do with the stuff after you buy it? But the first thing you start with is the communist boss in the region. You go to a major city, comparable to a county seat, I would say, in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
You have an interview, and you better have somebody that knows him, and you have a nice discussion, and then you figure out what villages he wants you to pick in or you want to pick in, and then you bring in the bosses of the village, which is comparable to a mayor, and then we have another meeting, and then if everybody agrees, off we go.
Oh.
And when you knock a door in a Chinese village, you get into every single house. When you knock a door in the United States or the Western world, a good door knocker will do business. Well, they'll lie to you, but 1 out of 20 houses.
Wow.
They'll lie to you.
Wow.
Yeah, because I'll tell you, they get into every house.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
1 out of 20 is a good average. But that brings, I'm going to back up a little bit. There's different ways of knocking doors, and maybe we'll come back to that if you care to know. But I do blanket knocking where I knock virtually every door, and 1 out of 20 is a good average. So in China, where in the United States, where you're trying desperately to get in and visit a home so you can make offers on items, in China, the problem is that people are dragging you by the arm to go in their house. They're terrified that you're going to run out of money before you get to their house. And you have to visit every part of the house. So you're in the bedroom, you're in the kitchen, you're in the storage room and the bar. It's no problem to gain access to the house.
Mm.
And the Chinese women seem to be the bosses of the house,
mm-hmm.
and they're screaming and yelling in the street, so much so that you actually have to almost hand out number to them.
Oh, wow.
And then so when you find something to buy, you make an offer.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever you offer, they always want more.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to offer a little bit lower. You come up the price a little bit,
mm-hmm.
and 95 out of 100 times they say yes. You drag the item out into the street. You go on to the next house.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have your truck driver come, and they pick everything up with the truck.
Mm-hmm.
Heaven forbid that you should have to find a place to go to the bathroom or to buy a sandwich or a bottle of water in these villages, because none of those places exist,
mm-hmm.
except for the open latrines. So that's an interesting thing. But you get everything loaded up in the truck. When you get a full truck or however many trucks, usually you can do about a three-quarters of a truck in a village. So you get three trucks loaded up. It goes to Beijing. You check the load when it gets to Beijing at the warehouse. And if everything is there, you pay the truck driver the total amount of money that you would have spent. Then the truck driver goes to the Communist Party boss, who takes his 10%. Then the village bosses get their 10%. The truck driver gets the fee, and then whatever's left gets percentage apportioned to the individual owner. So the pie gets divided up quite a few times.
Jeez.
Wow, that's not an easy task.
How did you learn how to do all of this?
Well, it's learn how to knock doors. It's the same anywhere in the world.
Huh.
You look for stuff that you want to buy and buy it at a price, which is, we could discuss prices as well if you're interested later. But the how-to is simply a matter. It took over 2.5 years of me being in China and learning the Chinese way,
mm-hmm.
and getting the right translator and the right antique dealer that had access to the right Communist Party boss. And once you get access to one boss, then you have access to them all.
Jeez.
I could segue into Spain, where the first time I went to Spain, I went to the Costa del Sol because a friend of mine was on vacation, said we can buy here. And I said, how are we going to buy down there? This is a tourist area, so you're the most expensive area of the country.
Mm.
And he said, we can buy 100 brass and iron beds for $50 a piece. I said, if that's true, we cannot lose money. So we went down and we bought from the gypsies down there. And at the end of that container, we had, I think, $65,000 worth of stuff in the container, and with expenses and merchandise. And when we sold it, we sold for $75,000,
yeah.
and that was two people splitting the profit, and that's not enough for 3.5 weeks' work.
Yeah.
The next time we went to Spain, we skipped the gypsies on the Costa del Sol. We found some gypsies up in the interior. We filled the container for $17,000 and sold for about $75,000.
Well, that's more
money.
Now the numbers get interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
And once you find one gypsy that's good, there's good gypsies and bad gypsies. The bad gypsies are thieves, and you can't buy from them because they steal to get their stuff, and then they steal from you to get it back.
Oh.
So you can't buy from the bad gypsies, but the good gypsies you can buy from. As soon as you meet one gypsy that's good, then you'll meet his cousin in the neighboring province or the neighboring county or the neighboring state, and then you get networked.
Mm.
And then when you meet the right gypsies, they'll take you to the villages where you can go door to door, and then there your support system there again with the trucks, the warehouse space, the terrenos, the land where you can put the stuff, and then of course you have to handle the international shipping yourself. So it's the same almost in any country, except for France, like I said, where the French aren't very cooperative. But
right.
That's another story for another day.
Jeez.
Well, getting back to the States, I was about 18. I went on the road with a door knocker one time, and it was quite an experience. And
this was a female door knocker, was it not?
That's right. I think I told you about that.
Who is very, very good at her trade.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. But when we went together, I was 18. She was young, and she was just starting to hone her skills. But I tell you, it takes real thick skin to knock on a door, wouldn't you say?
Well, yeah. If you're shy and if you have a thin skin, you're not going to last as a door knocker. There's many, many no's.
Yes. The door will get shut in your face for sure.
Absolutely. And there's hardly a door in New England that hasn't been knocked before.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, the excitement of picking is to get into an untouched house.
Mm-hmm.
And I could tell a story or two about that. But you have to catch the people at the right time. They have to be in the mood.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to be persuasive enough to, quote, get your foot in the door. Some guys literally will put their foot in the door and pretend not to go away. Those people usually don't last long in the business and very often get arrested or shoot out of town by the local authorities. But when you're in, then you got to be careful, too. I remember this lady in Vermont was very pleased to see me come to her house. It was an early home, 1820s home. And she gave me a carte blanche to walk through the home. She sat at the kitchen table. I came down all bright-eyed and bushy-tailed from the attic and said, there's a beautiful brass and iron bed there. Could you take $100 for it? She said, you bet, sonny. So I handed her $520s, and she took them out of my hand so fast, shoved them down the front of her blouse, said, okay, get your bed out. So I went back upstairs, and the bed wouldn't come out. And I moved left and right and up and down and looked at the windows, and I came back down. I said, I'm really sorry, ma'am. I said, the bed, you remodeled here. They said, oh, yeah, years ago we remodeled. I said, well, the bed won't come out of the attic. She said, you should have thought about that before you paid me, sonny.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
And I left without my $100, and I know perfectly well I was not the first person.
Wow.
Isn't that something? Now, didn't you end up getting married by knocking a door one time?
I had a feeling that you were going to ask me about what's the best thing I ever bought when I knocked the door. Okay, and that's where we get back into the prices and what you pay and what you sell for. That's where a lot of people want to clam up. But actually, it's funny because I had a better example to talk to you about, and I will talk about both. The answer is yes. I went to visit my sister in California. I had never been to the place, and I got turned around in the beach neighborhood in San Diego, and I started knocking on doors, and the second door I knocked on, I said, I'm looking for my sister, Andrea Willett, but you're not here. You're not her. You're much prettier. And she says, well, I know who she is, and I'm married. And I said, well, would you like to go out with supper with me tonight anyway? And she said yes, and she became wife number two. So it took about 6 or 8 months, but she was on her way out. So, yeah, I actually found wife number two by knocking doors.
Uh-huh.
Wow.
She was very difficult, and it brings me around to what I was going to tell you about my best knock ever.
Okay, let's hear that.
We courted in San Diego, dated in Kansas City, got married in St. Louis, and then moved to Maine when we had our two boys, and that's where we were going to establish my business. And so anyway, we moved to Kennebunk. The school district was good, but we rented for a year, and the time came to buy a house. And she looked at 40-plus houses, driving the real estate agent crazy.
Oh,
wasn't happy with any of them. I finally said to her, Linda, where do you want to live? She said, in the neighborhood here between Route 1 and da-da-da-da-da. It was a triangle in downtown Kennebunk. It had about 40 houses in it, and none of them were for sale. So I started at one end of the neighborhood, and I started knocking. Hi, my name's Greg Will, and I'm buying antiques. And by the way, I'm looking to buy a house. About house number 7 or 8, the guy says, oh, I don't know this. I'm a renter. Well, I stopped knocking doors that day. I went down to the city hall, found the owner in New Hampshire. And I called him up and said, do you want to sell that rental? He said, you bet I do.
Oh.
And I bought the house within 2 months. I think I paid like $62,000 for it. 2 years later, I sold it for $122,000. So that was a good door knock.
Oh, yes. And you lived there, yes?
Oh, yeah. I moved in. I bought it, and the wife was happy temporarily. And
temporarily.
So that's how I found the house.
Uh-huh.
Jeez, when you want something, you just got to ask for it, right?
So let's hear some stories about some of your adventures when you knocked on those doors.
What kind of story? You want to hear about the untouched museum, or do you
let's start with
about...
that, and then I want to hear some unusual, because the only single day in my life I ever door knocked with the person I was talking about earlier, I had some unusual things happen in that one single day, so... You must have some great stories.
In Cape Breton, Nova Scotia, is a very Scottish neighborhood, and Mrs. McDougall, 95 or 6 years old, lives in the farm by herself. And we knock her door, and she cautiously lets us into the garage. And there's a stairs go up the side to the overhead attic in the garage. And we went up, and there was a sea chest. I said, Mrs. McDougall, I can buy the sea chest and offer you $50 for it. I have to see what's in it. So she's teetering up these stairs, and she gets to the top. I pull the sea chest out from the wall because of the pitched roof so we could open up the lid when she could see in. When she went to look in the sea chest, she lost her balance, pushed against the sea chest, which moved closer to the wall, where the lid came down, hit her across the forehead, and knocked her unconscious on the floor of the attic.
Oh, no.
Bleeding profusely up the forehead.
Oh, my God.
That's when the first thing that comes to your mind is the three-letter word, run. So we did run. We went downstairs, got in the kitchen, got some wet rags, got her compressed. She had no phone, but she came to, and she had the biggest lump you ever saw on her head, and she was in a moderately understanding disposition, not happy having let us in, but realizing it wasn't our fault that she got hit. And we offered to take her into town, and we did, and took her to a doctor, and well, we were done in that neighborhood.
Oh,
yeah.
No, no.
Anything to do with it.
Now, you said she was 95 years old?
Yes, and every bit of 95, if not 96, yeah. And spry as a cat. another time I was in rural Maryland, and there was in a farm, there was a shed, and in the was a buggy. Hung up on ropes, and we negotiated the price of the buggy, and it was fine, and the farmer and I are lowering the rope down, and he was on the door side of the barn, and I was on the inside of the barn, and the bees were on the inside of the buggy. So 10-plus bee stings later, I realized next time I do this, I should be on the barn side, the door side, instead of the inside of the barn. So that was a surprise.
Yeah.
I had a gentleman suffer a heart attack when I was trying to talk my way in the front door.
Oh, no.
He went from white to gray as I was introducing myself or giving him my little spiel. And he tipped over through the screen door and at my lap. But there was a phone there, and they called 911, and we performed some CPR on him, and he survived. Oh. That was a surprise.
Yeah. Such your average door knock.
Did you ever get in any fist fights?
Not indoor knocking, no. But I've had people threaten to shoot me if I didn't get off their property, and I've had dogs try to come after me. But that's very typical. That's all in the day's work there.
Are you a fast runner?
Yes, you better believe it. Heels and elbows. That's all you see when I run. Heels and elbows. It's funny. Fist fights. There's a lot of competition between door knockers. One door knocker is always trying to figure out a way, because like I told you before, there's very few doors that haven't been knocked before. And I can tell you about Jacques Gilbert, who was a very, very good picker, and he worked in the Maritimes. He was a Quebec picker. Hmm. As a matter of fact, Quebec is a cradle of picking. If Maine has 10 good pickers, and Vermont has 10, and New Hampshire has 10, Quebec has 50.
Wow.
It's an all-time way of life for these people.
Wow.
And Jacques Gilbert was relentless, and we were working the same section of the Maritimes, and I knocked on the door once, and he had been in two or three houses where I'd been and said some things that weren't exactly complimentary about me. And so I knocked on this door, and the lady says, "Oh, I have some things, but I always sell to that nice picker, Jacques Gilbert." I said, "Oh, ma'am," I said, "I'm so sorry you didn't hear." "No, what?" I said, "He was killed in a car accident last week." And I proceeded to buy a lot of stuff from him. About 2 months later, I ran into Jacques at one of the pickers' picks in Quebec. The pickers bring their stuff to the dealers, and they sell at wholesale, they call them picks, once a week. Mm-hmm. And he walks up to me and taps me on the shoulder. He says, "I am not dead." I know.
Good stuff.
One other story along those lines of antagonism and pickers' jealousy. There's a picker who's, I'll call him, I'll just use the first letter of his name, K. And he is a real, real slime bag and very aggressive. And he would steal from his mother. Oh. And at one point, he overheard me discussing with another door knocker, who was my partner, about a such and such that we had found in a house. And my partner says, da-da-da, and I said, "That street." So now he knows where we were picking. He knows the name of the street. He knows the item. And he immediately went and bought it. And it was a significant item, a multi-$1,000 item that the people were waiting to talk to another family member before they told us yes or no.
Oh, no. Mm.
So, well, that's okay. So revenge is sweet.
Uh-oh.
We waited at best served cold. So we waited about 6 months. And at the time, not only were we picking in Canada, we were buying in Europe. We had two 18th century French chairs worth about $500 for the pair that we had brought from France. And but if they had been Canadian chairs, they were worth about $5,000.
Oh.
Early French Canadian chairs. Mm-hmm. So we had a repairman that lived in a small village. So we took the chairs to the repairman's mother's house, put them in the basement, and told him to expect a call from a bald man. And, oh, 4 or 5 days later, we're at breakfast, and we started talking about the great French-Canadian chairs that were in the basement of such and such village.
You set this guy up?
About 50 houses in the village. He got up from the restaurant, threw his money down on for the check, and stormed off to his truck and left a cloud of gravel and dust in the parking lot. He was in such a hurry. And sure enough, 3 days later, he paid $6,000 for these chairs because we told the lady not to sell them for less than $6,000. So he has them at his pick, and the big expert from Quebec came and told him that they were from France and they were worth $500.
Oh my God. Wow.
That's a heck of a story. Oh, my God.
Well, and it was a big hurt on him, but it felt really good when we spent all that money.
Jeez. Unbelievable. Hey, I wanted to tell you, I had talked to, you and I had talked, I don't know, last fall, and you had mentioned a couple of names of some of the great pickers in the country, and I ran into one of them and asked to do this podcast. I'm not going to mention his name, but I will say that he was hesitant to talk to me on the podcast because he said that that he might get in trouble from some of the buys that he made ethically. And what do you think about that?
Well, it's a very real concern. And mm-hmm. in any line of work, there's people that are really good at what they do, and then there's also the ethical standards which they hold themselves to. Door knockers. There's one school of thought that when you knock a door, it's a lot like hunting deer. It's an adversarial situation. Then when you're in the woods and you've got a 10-point buck in front of you, you don't yell, "Excuse me, I'm going to pull the trigger." So there's when you're knocking doors, your job, you don't make any money unless you buy them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how you buy is where the ethics come in. And then what is the value of a piece, too? Let's think about if you go to an orchard and you buy a bushel of apples. I don't know what they cost because I've never done that, but let's say a bushel is $10, which means an apple might be 10 or 20 cents. If you go to a shopping mall and there's a croissant and a frappuccino, the apple's going to cost a dollar and $1.50.
Mm-hmm.
So what is an apple worth, 10 cents or $1.50? And it has to do on its location. So if it's in New York City, or if it's at an international antique show, or if it's in the basement in rural Maryland or Missouri. So that is a question that you have to address. And the old-time pickers and door knockers would say, you buy with the customer's eye, and you do whatever it takes to get the stuff bought, and you buy as cheaply as you can.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my uncle, and a lot of very successful pickers consider it to be an adversarial situation. When I decided that I wanted to knock doors, and the why of knocking doors is another question that I'll come back to in a second. But when I decided I wanted to knock doors, my rule was buy with their eyes, but don't be brutal, because you want them to be happy when you leave, you want them to be happy 3 months later, and you want them to network you and refer you to their friends.
Sure.
So you have to establish a fair price. Now, there's legal implications. If somebody doesn't, let's talk about a $1,000 item that somebody might have that they put in their yard sale for $10. And if Joe Blow comes along and buys it for $10, takes it to an appraisal day and finds out that it's worth $1,000, yay, everybody goes, oh, great, what a good buy. If Greg Willett, the antique dealer, or the unnamed picker we're talking about, goes in, sees the item, knows it's worth $1,000, offers $10 for it, there is legal grounds for damages, because the
sure.
buyer willfully and knowingly is paying far less than it's worth, and it's not legal in almost every state.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where the ethical rub comes in.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of guys who know perfectly well what they're buying that are buying for pennies on the dollar, that's where the rub comes in. Which brings me around to something contemporary. For example, in the American Pickers, you will see many segments where they say, oh, we bought that cash register for $200. I can't wait to get it to our appraiser to find out if we're going to make money or not. And it's all I can do to keep the smile off my face, because those guys have been in business for a very long time. I know them well, and they know perfectly well what that cash register is worth when they buy it. Mm-hmm. But because of this legal ramification, they are adding that into the element of the show. So in case it's worth $2,000, they don't have legal recourse to worry about.
Yes, yes.
In civil courts, you could be liable for damages in any civil court if they can prove that the ignorant buyer is safe from legal action, but a knowledgeable buyer who willfully and knowledgeably pays far, far less, and there's guidelines, Maine is 3 times the value. So it's definitely a concern. And I'm going to tell you, every door knocker that's been around for more than a year knows when something's good, and the degree of his knowledge, that's up for a judge to decide. I'm going to tell you that the best buys that I've gotten in my career, the highest hit, the biggest hits, the highest markups, have always been by me buying from other dealers. Because when I'm in a house, I always make sure that I pay enough that I can sleep tonight. And when I go back into a town, that my name is good and not mud.
Mm-hmm.
But it's when other dealers get stuff, and dealers are supposed to be knowledgeable, they're setting their own price. And if somebody sets a price of $700 on something and it's worth $30,000, I'm not going to tell them otherwise.
Sure.
And on and on and on. So dealers can make money off of other dealers. Well, I just listened to podcast number 40, and we were talking about someone offering a screen for $800 and bought $9,000. Well,
yes.
All dealers, so same idea.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Have you ever heard of a door knocker sending in someone to buy something in their stead because they know that, if they show up?
No, that wouldn't happen. But I tell you what does happen is you go in and you buy the item and you know that you've paid far, far, far too little for it. Well, the first thing you do is you go sell it to one of your friends for a modest markup. And then he will sell it to one of his friends for another markup. Mm-hmm. And then it will be marketed in a national venue, an auction or something, or placed privately. And then after that has sold at the high price, then there'll be a trickle back of the money. Mm-hmm. And that's collusion, and it's just a different form of collusion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, have you ever bought something by accident that you just was totally out of your field and did very well with it?
Yeah, absolutely, because we learn all the time.
Sure.
We learn all the time. Mm-hmm. And I'm constantly amazed at what people are willing to pay for certain things. I recently bought a stack of Packer programs, and I had a basic knowledge that they were worth $10 to $20 a piece, and I bought them knowing that some were going to sell and some weren't going to sell, and that I needed to make a profit on the pile. One of them turned out to, I sold it on the internet for $272.50. Now, that's not big money, but it's a big markup when you're paying $4 a piece for them.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that it brought so much was because it was a specific championship game.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the case where I couldn't have been more surprised, but I didn't feel bad about buying them across the board because I'm still looking at a stack of 20 or so that I will never sell. So
right.
The answer to your question is yes, all the time.
Have you accumulated a lot of things, or are you pretty good at just turning it around and selling it?
The best people in the business are buyers and sellers, not savers.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody wants to go buy from the door knocker who kept the best 3 things out of the load.
Yes.
But a lot of the guys... a lot of smart guys would stop before they got home and drop stuff off at a garage they rented or at a friend's house and take the special items to a higher level without rubbing salt in the wound of their daily customers, saying, you can't have these 3 things, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So there's marketing techniques that where you don't necessarily sell everything to your customers at the time you pick it. But no, I'm not a collector. We talked about wife number two. Number one and I were in business together, and when that relationship went south, Rafer was that I would keep the house and she would keep the antiques. And when the U-Haul truck pulls up in front of the house and all your special babies are getting whisked away, that kind of soured me from collecting from that point on.
Hmm.
Oh.
It's the fun is to find the stuff for me and to sell the stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The hunt and then the sell I consider to be the kill.
Mm.
And the reason that people knock doors, I think the number one reason is because it's you're finding it first before anybody else, and there's no other profit involved other than the original owner and you. And Marty, I hesitate to say this because I know you're a very good auctioneer, but there's nothing I like less than sitting in an auction hall and being the person that pays the most for something.
Right, right.
That's true.
Not that there's not money to be made,
right.
But now it's not just sitting in the auction hall, it's paying the most of anybody on the internet or the world as well.
Yeah.
Speaking of the internet, since you've been door knocking so long, what do you think has changed since the internet has come around?
From the door knocking perspective, I think very little. The people that will open the door and let you look through the garage or the basement or dig in the attic or the spare room are not the people that are involved in the internet. The people that are savvy, that like collectibles and the antiques, that use the internet would never, ever, ever let you in the front door.
Mm.
So that really, on the buying end, I don't think it's had any effect at all. On the selling end, it's transformational. It's just been remarkable.
Mm.
My grandmother in a town of Portsmouth, New Hampshire, had one of these wonderful houses that every picker in the world knocked on that door. And she would just say, well, my grandson's Martin Willis, the auctioneer, and they'd see you later. Goodbye.
Right.
But she used to tell me, it seemed like every few weeks, oh, yeah, this such and such knocked on my door. Or this was slid under my door, she would show me. It was pretty funny.
In the country, especially in Vermont over that way, a lot of the farmers, they'll take your cart and pin it right on the inside of the door frame. And so when they you come up and they go, you're a little early this year. The mud's not even out of the road. You're already knocking, huh? Come in, take a look. And the whole door frame, bottom around the top, it'll be covered with cars.
That's so funny.
Wow.
Wow.
Well, one time I was in central Indiana, and I was in a home. There was a one-drawer wallet stand table, and I opened the drawer, and it said, I belong to Clark Garrett if they ever decide to sell this. And he was one of the biggest pickers in Ohio. So
that's
wow.
Really funny.
Wow,
I can tell you another a very interesting coincidental story.
Oh, yeah.
One day I was on the eastern shore of Maryland at a giant auction called Crumpton, which is weekly. I had come down to visit my family, and we were spending a week vacation in Annapolis, Maryland, which is a good 75, 100 miles away. So I sold a load at the auction. And one of the items I sold was a wooden wheelbarrow in old blue paint, and it brought $125. And I was well pleased at that time for that price. Mm-hmm. And 3-4 days later, we're in Annapolis, and the kids were at the swimming pool at the marina. And I was getting a little antsy, and I told my wife, I'm going to go out and knock doors. And I drove 5 miles down a country road, and there's a little gravel road, and I turned down that road, go up the hill, and there's a Tidewater mansion, circa 1840s. Beautiful place, come up the top of the circular driveway, and my wheelbarrow is in the center of the flower garden.
Wow.
And I'm looking, and I say, yeah, okay. So I knock the door, and the lady's very gracious, and she lets me walk through the barn and a couple outbuildings, and I bought a watering can, and I bought, I don't know, like a bucket bench. And as I'm leaving, I said, I buy wooden wheelbarrows. Would you sell me that wheelbarrow? She says, what would you pay for it? I said, $75. She said, I just bought that. Could you go $100? And I said, you bet I can. So 3 days before, she pays $125 for the wheelbarrow, and she sold it to me for $100 that day.
Wow.
What are the chances of me finding that wheelbarrow
again?
More than 75 miles away?
That sounds like a case of buyer's remorse to me.
I think the woman was having fun, and she had too much money, and she didn't like the way it looked as much as she thought.
Wow.
That's so weird.
Goes
around and another out. Really good place to knock doors is where the antiques are. For example, in the old days of Brimfield, we would come down and sell on Wednesdays, and Thursday was an off day. Sometimes I would go back up to Maine 4 hours and load another load out of the shop and bring a second load down. But other times, you can go right out downtown Brimfield. I know you were just there. They got the church in the center of town,
mm-hmm.
up on the hill. You take the left and go north out of that road, and you can start knocking doors within the first mile, and I guarantee you, a good door knocker, because I've done it on more than one occasion, you can fill up a load by the end of the afternoon. Because none of those antique dealers down there think about knocking doors. They're all there to sell. That area is a good knocking area.
Wow, you're really generous with the tips, Greg.
Yeah.
You're fearless.
Door County is a tourist area up here. It's like the coast of Maine. And number three wanted to do a show up there.
Wait a minute. You mean wife number three?
Yeah, of course.
Oh, yeah. Okay, sorry.
By the way, Phyllis, I'm looking for number four.
Wow.
I think I'm too old for you. So we did this little show outside of Antique Mall in the middle of a week in July, supposed to hooking the tourists to getting to spend their money. So I set her up, and I said, I'm going to go knock doors. And a couple of the other people said, you're crazy. You can't knock doors up here. I said, you watch. The second door I knocked, I bought a 12-foot long hook rug. And the next three doors, I didn't do any good. The next door, they told me, come back after lunch. So I came back to the show. They said, what did you buy? I said, I only bought this hooked rug. They go, oh, well, it was killer. But, you know, I still wasn't good enough. I went back after lunch and bought two wardrobes, one in old red paint and one in mustard, an early handmade chest, two trunks, and a whole bunch of small stuff. I filled my whole van up in one day, and that was within 2 miles of the major highway in the tourist area.
Wow.
So just because it's a tourist area or an antique area doesn't mean that you can't find antiques.
Wow.
The most fun of all is based on the rule that neighbors don't do business with neighbors. And I learned this a hard way. I'm sitting at my house in Kennebunk eating lunch, and Hap Moore, who you know, is an auctioneer and a picker, pulls into the driveway of my neighbors next to me. They open up the door to the 18th century blacksmith shop that I knew was there. It had been in the family ever since day one, and he cleaned that place out. The tears streamed down my cheeks, and I watched my friend, a neighbor, sell everything to Hap Moore. That it's because neighbors don't do business with neighbors.
Interesting.
So when I moved to Wisconsin, the big dog on the street in this town, his name is Jack, I went right to his street, and I started knocking his street, and right across the dead across from his front door, I pulled an 1810 Heppelwhite slant front desk out of that basement for $40.
Whoa.
And I walked right across the street and asked him if he wanted to buy it. He was so mad.
Greg, have you ever had like a 9-to-5 job?
Work?
When I was 16, I worked at the Heck Company department store selling ladies' shoes, and I wore a little sports jacket and a polyester tie. It was a clip-on. And I liked that because it was commissioned, but not that much. And then I had a summer job with IBM because my dad was a big wig, and he dropped dead early, and I had the, what we call the sympathy job. I was 17 years old, and they gave me a nice job in the summer, and I realized that I was never cut out for corporate work. And then I did work for the state of Maryland for a short period of time as a marine biologist, and that reinforced my dislike for corporations and ineffective government bureaucracies. When I came to back home and told my wife I had quit the job with Maryland, she said, what? What are we going to do? I said, we're going to buy and sell antiques. She cried for the better part of a week.
Oh, Greg.
But it ended up pretty good.
Well, yeah, I guess. Somebody asked me if I was going to retire. I just had the last birthday I can have and not be 60. And somebody said, when are you going to retire? And I just looked at them like they were crazy. I was on vacation last week, Marty, up in Canada. And I was camping with friends. These are all friends I met from my time that the antiquing I'd done in Quebec. And the morning of the fifth day, I knew I'd had enough because I woke up and I started thinking about going picking or knocking doors or what could I buy. And that told me it was time to get home.
Have you ever had an apprentice, Greg?
An apprentice?
Yeah.
I tried to teach my two children. I dragged them all over half the world, showing them how to knock doors because I needed somebody to drag their leg behind them.
Yes.
Kidding. And they had no interest, which is good. And I partnered with many, many door knockers. It's always more fun to do it with somebody else.
Sure.
And it becomes competitive. You pick sides of the street, see who has the better day. You see who gets into the house first. You see who has the biggest hit. And Michelle Prince is one of the best door knockers in, and one of the preeminent antique dealers as well in Quebec. And he hooked up with a guy named Jean-Pierre Labbé, who learned from him. Jean-Pierre picked for Jimmy Sears for years, who was a major, dealer in Maine. He's had some hard times lately. Jean-Pierre comes knocking on my door, and we were both door knockers, but we hooked up together. We both learned from each other. It takes, I've had employees that I brought with me to and tried to teach, but it's not something that's easily taught. For example, Martin, you you went out with M.
Yes.
And she's done very well, but you found it wasn't in your nature to do it.
That's right.
Yeah, it's not in everybody's blood, so it's the apprentices are hard to find.
I see. Mm-hmm.
Everybody wants to be an apprentice until they realize. I can remember one period here in Wisconsin, dead of winter, I knocked doors for 20 days and did not buy a single thing. It was freezing cold, 9 to 11:30 and 1 to 4. And, you know, it's hard to get back up and knock the next door after that happens. But so no apprentices, Phyllis.
Okay, Greg, can we close on one more? You must have one more interesting story you can think of.
I'm going to tell you about the best treasure house I ever found. And the reason it was the best house is because it was totally unpicked and untouched. It was on the South Shore of Nova Scotia. The house dated from about 1795-1800. And when you drive by, you can see that it's old and it's untouched. And also, there's no driveway. And I had noticed the house many times. We'll go back to areas because we keep a good door knocker will keep a file and oh, there's a such and such in this house, or go see Mrs. Smith in 6 months, she might be in the mood to sell something, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And I had noticed this house many times, maybe 5 or 6 times, and I'm driving down one summer and there's a car in the driveway with Massachusetts plates, and it's an old Buick, and I know it's Seniors, and I knock on the door, and it's the great-great-great-grandson of the original owner, and his family's been coming up there for years, and he and his wife are there for a 2-week vacation. And he said, yes, please come in. He was very gracious. Nothing had, no antique dealer had ever been in that house because nobody was ever home when they came by. The cupboards were full of redware. The mantel place in the dining room was covered with the original Victorian cloth. I would call them dingleberry decoration. The paintings on the wall original. There was the newest thing that I could see was a square oak table and a set of 6 press back chairs. But there's a chair table in the summer kitchen with a set of 6 Windsors around it. The quilts, it goes on and on and on. It was like walking into a museum. And he was in the mood to sell, and nobody had ever offered to buy. And he started with small things in the closets and upstairs in the attic. And the redware and the quilts and the silhouettes and on and on and on. And then in the guest rooms, the blanket chest and the Chippendale chest went on. And I went 3 or 4 times to that house until they pinned down enough of what they only had, what they needed. And it wasn't so much the money, which was significant, but it was the fact that I could come in, and it's just like opening the King Tut's tomb for the first time. So that's. And the fact that he was gracious and nice and that we had an ongoing business relationship where I could schedule my visits over the course of the summer, and it was a win-win on both sides, and it was a whole bunch of really nice stuff that I was well pleased to own.
Great.
Very nice story.
Well, we're out of time.
Thank you so much. It was a lot of fun, Greg.
I was invited. Now, Marty, you remember me. You invited me to come to your house at one point.
That's right. Yes.
I might take you up on it when you least expect it, so you, Phyllis, and I can go out and have a nice supper.
All right. Sounds good. All right. So this is Martin Willis.
And Phyllis Gall.
With Greg Willett in Wisconsin, and we're all signing off.
While you are on our website, antiqueauctionforum.com, please stop by the forum message board. Click on the community tab at the top of the menu bar, and you can join in on a topic, post your own website links, and do a lot more. Thanks so much for listening, and we hope you enjoyed today's show.